Welcome to Rock and Roll Garage. All right, how we doing? What's going on out there? Appreciate you joining me here. Rock and Roll Garage, every Thursday night, at least for a while. Listen, I have been looking forward to this interview here this evening, and I know a lot of you are as well. My first guest, well, my only guest this evening is Pat DeCesar. Pat's with me now. He grew up in Trafford, PA, near Pittsburgh. Guess what? The biggest employer there was Westinghouse. He was the youngest of, just like here, he was the youngest of 10 children. Pat quit his job at Westinghouse to stock shelves at a record company, which is where his ascent to stardom began. Pat went on to become the biggest concert promoter in the Pittsburgh, and certainly one of the biggest in the United States, founding DeCesar Productions, eventually DeCesar England Productions. And Pat is with me now. Hey, man, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah, fine.
Okay, all right, yep. Cool. Hey, listen, man, I read your book that you wrote a few years back. I read it in one sitting. I couldn't put it down, but I read it as a Kindle version. And I felt like so much of it was so close to my life. I know you went to YSU. We have a Westinghouse here in town that I worked at and quit. I work for a record company, actually, Arrow Records in Cleveland. And I actually worked at Conneaut Lake Park. So much of your story resonated with me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
all great memories.
Well, let's start with your beginning in show business. You got a job at the Holiday House in Monroeville. Talk about that scene and what that was like for you, Pat.
Oh, that was the most fabulous thing. I got my driver's license. I was 16. I was like a junior in high school. And I heard this nightclub was going to open. And Monroeville was probably 5 or 7 miles from where I lived. And boy, I drove out there, and before it actually opened, it was being built. And I was able to get a job as a busboy. But every act that was on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was the biggest thing at that time, they would end up working at the Holiday House, performing there, you know? So working as a busboy, I got to see all those big acts. And I never thought about being in the business, in the concert business because of that. I just needed a job, you know.
Sure. Well, who do you remember? Who's the most memorable act that you saw there, Pat?
Well, there were a lot, but like the favorites were like Xavier Cugat, for example.
Right. Wow.
And I mean that he was just something to see. And There was a lot of guys that, you know, as the busboy, the head of the busboy was this guy, Johnny. Well, there were several Johnnies there. But anyway, one of them, he operated the spotlight. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get that job as a spotlight operator, you know, because you got to meet the act.
Right.
And then
one
day he asked me to be his assistant, you know. And so you know, I got to, you know, like I said, hang out and meet him. Harry James was for me a big name,
right.
And I, you know, I couldn't believe he was married to Betty Grable
at the time,
and she was just, you know, a knockout. And I would get to be with these guys. Then there was always like three acts on the show. There was always like the opener would be like a dancer, and nobody was interested in that.
Sure,
you know,
right.
Then the comedian, then a singer, something to that effect.
I think you wrote that Buddy Hackett was there. Was he one of the funniest?
Yeah, no question about it. You're right. But all the acts were great there.
Yeah. So
and you could get like
for
$5.90. $5.90, you got to come in, you got dinner and a shower. It was something really phenomenally cheap.
Well, it's an amazing story. And, I wish that we could, I actually would, you know, it would take us hours to tell your whole story. But I'm going to skip a little bit ahead here in the timeline. You worked at Westinghouse and quit there. And you began working for a record distributor in Pittsburgh. They were jukebox operators. And I have to ask you, when I hear jukebox operators in quotations, we're near Youngstown here. That usually meant that they were connected, if you know what I mean. Was that the case with your
yeah.
with you down there?
Well, you know, I would get that all the time, and that was true. Here's the way it worked. There were slot machines.
Okay.
Like, that's legal today.
Yep.
In a casino, right? So if you own a bar or a club or something like that, these operators would want to get your slot machine business. And so the club owner would say, well, okay, but, you know, there's other things like I need a cigarette machine or
right.
a jukebox and
pool tables
and a bowling shop or yeah pool table, and the jukeboxes were always losers for these guys. They got a lot of play and they brought in a lot of money, but the problem was that you had to constantly change the records because new hits were coming up every day.
Right,
and if you had a Seberg or a Wurlitzer jukebox, and it had 200 plays on it, or 200 selections, you had 100 records, and you had to constantly be replacing them. And so the jukebox, that's where I came in. You know, that's a part of the record business I went into. So these guys would say to me, hey, I need the hits of today, you know, and some guys had 1,000 jukeboxes. So when I recommended something, this guy was going to buy 1,000 of them. And if he was going to change 2 or 3 records, that meant he was buying 2 or 3,000.
Right.
And if I was wrong about it,
right, sure. You
know, I never knew what these guys were going to come up with. But I was really good at selecting hits.
You had the ear for it.
I just knew what Pittsburgh wanted, what my area wanted.
Oh, that's good stuff. It really is. Oh, man. So a lot of people realize in the area that Dick Clark was a local guy. I believe he still has family in Boardman. And you were involved with Dick Clark for a while down there. And he got caught up in that payola scandal and came out of it unscathed. But talk about what that payola scene was like during the late 50s, early 60s there in the music biz.
Well, there were some disc jockeys who would take money to play a record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I never had that situation. There was some promotion man. I knew one guy, for example, he would just give certain disc jockeys $200 cash every week.
Wow.
And
that's a lot of money.
That was a lot of money.
Right, sure.
Yeah, because disc jockeys did not make a lot of money at the time, because with the radio stations felt and did was, it's, hey, you can go have your record hops,
right,
and you can use your time on air, blast away at those record hops.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you couldn't afford to pay, an individual couldn't afford to pay all those spots that's going to have a record hop.
Sure.
But these disc jockeys would do 2,000-3,000 people at a time, you
yeah.
know, and
yeah.
that was their form of payola
yeah.
that way. But the guys, I mean, Alan Freed in Cleveland, of course, was kind of notorious for taking money and playing records. Dick Clark was clean.
Yeah.
Dick wouldn't take money.
Right.
And yeah.
I know that Alan Freed got his start here at WKST, just south here in Newcastle, and he worked in Youngstown and Akron, worked through the region.
Yeah. You're right.
Yep. So as yeah. part of your start in the business, in the concert promotion business, a guy kind of gave you his business, and it was I was imagining the scene, and as you were walking out the door, he said, oh, and one more thing, I got this little place up north called Connie at Lake Park that you have to do dances and concerts at, and I love that part of the story. So talk about your time at Connie at Lake Park.
Well, when that person Tim Tormey, you're referring to, he was my mentor, and I worked for him for a long time when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
And he took me up there and introduced me to Mr. Freeland, whose family owned the park, And Mr. Freeland said to me, you know, you can do these dances, but I don't want any trouble. I can't ruin the reputation of the park. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, you know, so I'll be very selective. I know which acts to stay away
from. What year
from.
Would this have been, Pat, by the way? What was 61, 62?
65 when I
okay.
went there.
So now, people are still a little bit leery about the long-haired rock and rollers at that point, right?
Yeah. My problem was I was in the military. I just got off active duty, but I still had to remain in reserve status. At that time, Vietnam was getting bigger and bigger, and everybody, we were all on 24-hour alert.
Right.
So here I am. I had to have short hair because I was still in the military. All these other kids would have long hair,
sure.
The facial, you know, mustaches and beards, and I look like a jerk, you know. I was the only one around that had the short hair.
Right. What was that? What was that scene like at Conneaut, though? You'd have what, the Dreamland Ballroom there? Did you do dances and concerts? A lot of people there attending.
Yeah. Well, I did mostly everything at Dreamland. They did have a convention hall. I did do some Dick Clark shows in there,
mm-hmm.
but primarily every Saturday night from Memorial Day to Labor Day, I would have a dance. And the thing was different about my dances, I would bring an entertainer, someone who had a record. And since I was in the record business, I could tell in mm-hmm. advance, you know, when these records came out, who was going to be a hit in 3 months or 6 months from now. So I always had, you know, I had like Neil Diamond.
Wow.
I brought in there.
To Conneaut Lake? You brought Neil Diamond to Conneaut Lake?
Well, and I brought a lot of those acts, like, you know, like Red Rubber Ball, The Circle, for example.
Right.
And
doesn't exist a list. Do you have a list? You know, I publish a small historical newspaper here, Pat. People would love that story. But you don't happen to have a list of who played there when you promoted, did you, in 65?
Boy.
Does that still exist, or does it only exist in your head?
It only exists in my head. I'll see if I could ask around if anybody...
Yeah.
It worked for me, can remember.
Right,
that.
Right, sure. Well, I think what most people want to hear about, you know, in the book, by the way, I'm here with Pat DeCesar, by the way, who is of DeCesar Engler, eventually is DeCesar Engler Productions, and the book is Hard Days, Hard Nights, and really just a great local read. Your first concert was at YSU, and it was just awesome. But I think what a lot of people want to hear, Pat, is the story of the Beatles. I know that you brought the Beatles to Pittsburgh. And so just talk about how that whole scene happened and the bartender and all that different thing that happened with the Beatles.
Well, you know, in November of 63, or around the time President Kennedy was killed,
mm-hmm.
I ran into another a record promoter. He was a competitor of mine, and we were discussing what new releases we both had, what we were working on. And he said, hey, I got this record I want you to hear. You know, then he played me on the BJ and the Swan versions on the Beatles' first two releases. What do you think of this group? I said, wow, they sound pretty good.
What songs, Pat? What song would that have been? I apologize to interrupt. Do you remember what the songs were?
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, I will think of that.
Okay, yep, okay.
Second there. But anyway, he couldn't get the record played, and I thought, wow, you know, I really like that group. So when I went back to Pittsburgh, the guy I worked for had done a few concerts, like one or two concerts,
right?
And they were done in 3,700. A seat theater in the Pittsburgh area called the Syrian Mosque.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like your Istanbul auditorium,
right,
with
sure.
1,000 seats more. But so anyway, I said to him, you know, I just heard about this group, man. I think we ought to, let's bring them in. I'd like to bring them in. I said,
wow.
how about you and I doing this together? And I said, I'd like to bring, he's, you know, to the Civic Arena. He said, to the Civic Arena? That's 12,500 seats. You got to, I mean, that's a lot of seats, mm-hmm. you know. What's the name of this group? And I said, the Beatles. And he said, the Beatles? He said, I never heard of them. I said, yeah, I know. I said, that's what it is right now. He's, where are they from? I said, England. He said, forget it. He said, Americans don't like English artists. Mm-hmm. No one's going to pay to go see an English artist. And I knew that that was the case because we really thought that British music was corny mm-hmm. at the time. And that was in November. And it was their album, Meet the Beatles, which the first song or the first time was I Want to Hold Your Hand, did not come out. It didn't make the Christmas release. It came out, it was released on December 27th. Now, the reason that's important is all the record companies gear their releases to come out for Christmas sales before Christmas. If you come out the day or so after Christmas,
right.
you got a loser.
Right, sure, yeah, but, you lost that opportunity, right?
Yeah, and here, this album, it just took off. It immediately, I mean, as soon as it came out, but it wasn't till a few months later when it was on Ed Sullivan that it really took off.
Right.
And all the pressing plants at that time had to stop. Everything they were doing, and all they did was press Beatles
wow.
LPs. The only way you could buy that song, I Want to Hold Your Hand, was on the album. It didn't come out as a single at first.
Mm. No 45, huh? I didn't realize
right.
that. Wow. So it wasn't even in jukeboxes anywhere, you're saying?
Pardon me?
It wasn't even in jukeboxes anywhere then, you're saying?
Yeah, because it was an LP.
Right, right. Okay, wow.
At first it was an LP.
So you talk about having to go to meet a bartender with $5,000. Help me understand how that seemed like it was I almost felt like it was a connected deal,
right.
if you follow me.
Crazy. Yeah, it was crazy. Well, anyway, I bugged the heck out of my mentor to be a partner. I said, I want to book this Beatles. I said, can you call the William Morris Agency in New York? That was the biggest theatrical agency
right.
at the time. And inquire about this act, the Beatles. And he said, I don't even want to bother calling.
Wow.
And I pestered the heck out of him. So finally, he called. Her name was Rosalind Ross at William Morris. And when he called her and told her, she said, you know, you're crazy. I mean, I don't know this act, but nobody's going to come to see an act from England. And he said, yeah, that's what I thought, you know. So he wouldn't make the calls anymore for me. So then I kept at it, and I found out. I read or heard where the manager was Ira, I'll think of his last name.
Right.
But I knew his brother was an agent at General Artists Corporation. So I told my guy, Tim, to call GAC, and the brother mm-hmm. knew about the Beatles. He says, look, he said, they won't come to Pittsburgh, to the United States until it's proven that they're number one.
Mm.
They don't want to come to the U.S. I mean, because here, you know, England, Texas is probably twice
right.
the size of England.
Right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
And so what if they're big in England? I mean, that's
yeah.
nothing.
Right.
I mean, so I had to prove that they could be number one in Pittsburgh. But the lucky break came for all of us when they appeared on Ed Sullivan in February of that next year. And when they were on Ed Sullivan, I mean, it was like that was the introduction of Beatlemania. You know, everybody got on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
So immediately they planned a U.S. tour. And since at first they weren't going to play Pittsburgh, and then when they thought like Pittsburgh was, they would pick, like they would only go to the real top cities.
Sure, yeah.
You know, like New York, mm-hmm. L.A., Chicago.
Right.
And so I said to my buddy, I said, you call that agent back and tell him that we're the guys that called in November when no one knew who the Beatles were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sure, everybody knows who they are, and now you're not going to give them to the guy in Pittsburgh, you know, that first called you?
Mm-hmm.
So they come back and they say, okay, you know, we thought about that, and you're right, so we'll give you a date, you know. And so they said, but there were two conditions. And they said, one was that you had to get $5,000 cash, put it in a brown paper bag.
Wow.
And deliver it to a bartender at the Club Elegant.
Wow.
In New York. And that was one. What the heck was the second condition? Well, I'll come back to it.
Right.
But anyway, that was enough to blow anybody away. So my job was now to get $5,000.
Get $5,000, sure.
Yeah. So I went to the guy I worked for, and he says, "You're crazy. I'm not going to put $5,000 in a brown paper bag and give it to a bartender."
Right.
Brooklyn. So okay, so I spent the whole day, you know, going to everybody in the record business that I knew. But nobody still had, even though they were proven on Ed Sullivan to be that big, nobody was convinced that they would just sell out the arena. I mean, generally it took like every time we had a show, anytime anybody had a show at the arena, which was rare.
Mm-hmm.
You put like 15, 20 acts on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And now here I'm saying, well, we could do it with the Beatles. So, I mean, I couldn't convince anyone to lend me $5,000. And so now I remember the second condition. That's why it's so important. You know, it was, I had to put $5,000 in the brown paper bag or the bartender, but I only had 48 hours to do
it. Wow.
So I'm scrambling around trying to raise that $5,000. Went to everybody, every radio station, every record store, record company, jukebox operators, because these guys, like you said, they sort of had a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a lot of these guys. I've been in their house. You know, you'd open their kitchen closet. Instead of there being pots and pans, nickels and quarters and dimes would fall out.
Right,
you know?
The jukeboxes, right. That's funny.
They had those coins everywhere.
Right.
You know? And I thought, well, okay, 5,000 to these guys is nothing. And not one of them would do that. They just thought, man, if you do that, I mean, you're the easiest sucker there is. You know, I mean, you're going to give your $5,000 to a bartender in Brooklyn. So I was not successful. And so the first day of the two, at the end of the day, I came home. I was living with my mom and dad. And I was telling them this story that, you know, my mother would say, okay, how was your day? I said, you know, I'm trying to get this act called the Beatles, and I'm trying, you know, I tell a story about the 5,000. And they didn't say anything. Now, my dad came from Italy when he was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
Got a job when he came to the United States, got a job as a coal miner. Then he got a job in a factory worker at Westinghouse Electric,
mm-hmm.
which was like a big move up for him.
Sure.
But I don't think my dad ever made a dollar an hour.
Mm.
Yeah, and he had 10 kids.
Wow.
And we live in this two-bedroom house, you know, and it's, you know, just dreadful at times, you know. The times there weren't even things to eat. But so the next day I go to work. I'm still trying to raise $5,000. I can't do it. I came back home that night to eat, where to stay. And I'm at the kitchen table, and after we're done eating, my dad slid an envelope across the table towards me. And I said, "What's this?" He said, "Oh, that's for you. Open it up." So I opened it up, and there was a check, and it was made out to me for $5,000.
Wow.
And I said, "Dad, it's a check for $5,000. Yeah, he said, "I know." I said, where did you get this? Yeah, I know you don't have this kind of money. And he said, "Well, I was able to borrow it at the credit union by agreeing to put up the house as security."
Wow.
"Dad, I can't take this. I mean, it's your house. I mean, this is a rock and roll group from England."
Right.
He said, "I mean, do you believe in this, Beatles?" I said, "Yes." He's when "You go take it. You go do the Beatles."
Wow, Pat, that is an absolutely wonderful story. I am here with Pat DeCesar, and that story, I read that story, but as you tell it, it is so much more impactful. We're going to take a short break here, just a minute or two break. We'll be back with more with Pat DeCesar in a short timeout. All right, welcome back. Appreciate you joining me here on Rock and Roll Garage. I'm here with Pat DeCesar, in case you just happen to be tuning in. He was the concert promoter in Pittsburgh, really invented the stadium concerts, and we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I'm going to finish this Beatles story for you.
Okay.
So it was February when we booked the Beatles for September the 14th.
All right.
Okay, so now, this is 1964, the Vietnam War is starting to boom, you know, and
yeah,
America's getting involved in it. So I got drafted, and I went on active duty, and I never got to see who was on stage.
You didn't get so you weren't present for the show.
No, I was on active duty.
That's got to make you nervous. You're putting up your money, but you're not there. That's got to be crazy.
Yeah, well, here's what though. when we put the tickets on sale, it sold out the next day.
Yeah, sure.
So I know, you know.
Yeah.
I knew I didn't. I was probably the richest private in the Army at the time.
That's what. So you're now. I think people say, "Oh, he booked the Beatles. He was, you know, a man." But you're really just a kid. I mean, you're living at home with your parents. It's it's an amazing story. It really is, Pat. And the story gets to better from there. It truly does. So you end up with the exclusive contract for the Civic Arena, which, of course, was built in, I don't know, 60, 61, something like that. You would know, but in the early 60s, there. And let's just go over some other incidents that you talk about in the book. Talk about the best that you can, the Janis Joplin incident at the Civic Arena.
Yeah, well, that was 1969, and she was like the first of like this cultural change that was happening in the United States. I mean, it started in San Francisco, maybe this in 67, but by the time it got to Pittsburgh, it was 69,
right.
And that's when I booked her. But she had the reputation, and I was aware of that. And so I thought I'd just pay close attention to her. So anyway, I booked her, and night of the show, you always have an opening act, and then intermission, and then the star comes on. So I told one of my assistants, I said, all right, let's bring the house lights down, get her, and let's get on the stage. And, you know, 5 minutes go by, and nothing's happening, you know. So the house lights then go down, and the crowd's cheering because
sure.
The next thing that should happen is she
right.
The spotlight should hit the stage, and she should be standing in front of a mic. So, but anyway, there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
So the audience starts chanting, you know, where is she? So the house manager comes back, and he said, hey, what's going on? You know, I've heard enough about this girl, and why isn't she on the stage? So I said to one of my assistants, I said, go back to the dressing room, see where she is, get her on the stage. He comes running back to me. He said, she's not going to be coming on stage right away. I said, why not? He's because she's fornicating in the dressing room. And the first thing I said, where in the world you learn the word fornicating?
Right. No one uses that word, right?
Yeah.
It was a nice, polite way of saying it, right?
Yeah. And he said, well, the stagehand told me, you know, that, and he was a little more sophisticated because he was used to doing the opera, the ballet, the symphony, you know,
right.
That stagehand. So I said, would you run back there and you tell her to get it over with and get up on that
stage.
Oh, my
gosh.
Get done with. And so he you know, he come back to me and he said, okay, he said, I think we're going to have a little problem. I said, what do you mean? He says, man, she's drinking that, what'd she drink, Jack Daniels?
I think so, yeah.
And he, cause, yeah, because he wanted, I had to buy her a case.
That was in her rider, Jimmy, right? Her rider was, she had to have a case of Jack Daniels.
Jimmy Vaccaro was my runner. Now, he lived in Trafford with me, you know, and his brother, Sonny, also lived in Trafford, mm-hmm. And we all went to Youngstown, and Jimmy now is like a really big deal in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
and of course Sonny Vaccaro doesn't need any introduction. But
well, let me stop you for a second, Pat. There may be some of my listeners who don't know that Sonny Vaccaro, they did a 30 for 30 on here recently. He's the guy that signed Michael Jordan to the Nike contract. And of course, started the Dapper Dan basketball tournament along with you. And if we have time, I'd like to get to that too. But go ahead.
Well, anyway, so Janice finally works her way up to the stage, wobbles up the steps, and so she gets to the microphone, and she is the first female performer that I ever knew. It used the F word,
mm-hmm.
And the audience loved it. I mean, they couldn't believe that they're hearing this, and they're shouting back to her, and she's repeating the words back to them. So I try to run up. You never want to go to the artists when they're performing on the stage. That's the worst thing anybody
right.
could do.
Right.
So the building manager, by now, he's behind stage, and he's saying to me, either you go up there and get her to shut up, quit swearing, or I'm going to turn the house lights on, and you're going to have to give everybody their money back, and I'm going to cancel this show, because I'm not going to have that kind of performance in my house. I says, well, I said, you know what, Mr. Strong, I said, if I do that, she's going to be awfully upset, and I don't know, I can't control what she's liable to do or say. You get up there right now, or I'm turning those lights on, I'm stopping the show. I said, yes, sir. So I go up to the, walk very slowly up to the microphone, and I'm standing on her right side. And she finally realizes I'm there, and she turns her head and looks at me and puts her two hands on her hips. And she said to me, and you, the whole audience could hear it,
sure.
Mike could pick it up. She said, "What the F do you want?" And of course, the audience loved that, you know. And
wow.
I try to whisper. I try to whisper in her ear. I said, "You know, the building manager doesn't like what you're doing. And if you don't stop that, he's going to turn the lights on. He's going to stop the show." And she said, "Well, you tell him that I said to go F himself." You know,
wow.
I said, "Janice, I can't do that." I said, "Look, let's just do two more numbers. The show will be over. And everybody can go home. You know, we'll cut the show short. I said, this way, you know, everybody can get paid. You get your money." And you get... She says, "I have news for you. You're paying me whether this show goes on or not." She said, "I showed up. I'm on this stage. I'm ready to perform. If you tell me you want me to go home, you still got to pay me the money."
Right.
And I knew she was right.
Yeah.
Because the contract only states that you got to show up. It really, you don't even, it doesn't say, "Hey, you have to sing 45 minutes. And unfortunately, that's the way it is. But I was never stiffed by any artist, you know. So she went on to swear. He turned the house lights on. Everybody rushed the stage, you know, and she continued using an F word. They're echoing the F word back to her. And, you know, it was like ping pong with the F word. And so Mr. Strong came up to me and he said, "You get her to stop it." He gave me another warning. "Is this your last and final warning?" And so I went back up and I begged her. I said, "Please, just do two more numbers." But she was so bombed, so out of it. Nothing made any sense. And I've had to deal with that situation several times. When you're dealing with somebody who's totally coked out and bombed out, nothing makes sense to them. I mean, they can't understand why you're acting the way you did. But she had a dress on. It was a net dress. Like, and you could see right through the dress. When a spotlight hit the dress, I mean, you could see right through it. And she had absolutely no underwear, nothing on under the dress.
Yeah. Right. But talk about inciting the crowd. Sure. I guess we forget, you know, we kind of forget how conservative people were and things were in the pre rock and roll days. You know, you talk a lot about theater owners that were, you know, they had been working there since the days of the '20s and there was nothing but operas there. And so these long hairs coming in there were a shock to people. It's crazy stuff. I did, security for a handful of concerts at Three River Stadium in the late '80s where I did the Stones and the Who and Pink Floyd. I worked for Burn Security. Were those your concerts, Pat, in the stadiums? Were those yours?
Yeah. I gotta admit, I did not do Pink Floyd. They got upset with me over something stupid. I had them at the arena, Pink Floyd, and sold out. And they wanted a Hammond B3 organ with two Leslie speakers, which was becoming common with all the acts. And so I had this law student who was one of my runners, and he was an intelligent kid. And I gave him the rider for Pink Floyd Civic Arena. I said, "Make sure you get this." And I said, "Stay with them for the rehearsal." And that's the other thing. You know, the act wants me as a promoter to be there for their rehearsal. Well, you know, I have other things on the day of the show. You know, I'm booking something 6 months in advance. I'm putting out fires with the arena manager, the police, the fire department, you know, the ticket office. It's just one big nightmare. That's why the title's Hard Days, Hard Nights. I mean, it wasn't hard just during the night. It was difficult during the day also, putting out fires. So you know, I just, I, she was without a doubt, you know, just like, just the toughest person to deal with.
Yeah. That's great. Let's just switch gears for a minute. We only have about 5 minutes left here. It's going quickly, but I know that you started the Dapper Dan tournament in Pittsburgh with Sonny Vaccaro, and Sonny's the guy that signed Jordan to the Nike contract. How did that whole thing transpire?
Well, you know, we grew up in Trafford. We went to college at Youngstown together, and one day he said to me, "Can I borrow your car?" And I said, "Yeah." So I said, "What's wrong with your car?" He's on nothing. He's, "I need two cars." He said, "I'm having this basketball tournament in Farrell." He says, "And I got to get team from Uniontown, a team from McKeesport." And
would that have been the Hoyle tournament? Pat, you know, this is where we're in Farrell here. Is it, would have been the Hoyle tournament, or would it have been Farrell High School tournament?
Farrell High School.
Okay, okay.
And so the next year, same thing came. And I said to him, "Hey," he wanted to borrow a car, you know, to do that. And I says, do many people come to this event?" He says, "Oh, yeah, it's jam-packed." I said, "Do you charge an admission?" He says, "No."
Your wheels are turning, right?
I said, "Why not?"
And right. He says,
"You can't charge an admission for something like that." I said, "Sonny, if people want to go to this and they're, you know, you have to turn them away, you got to, you got expenses too. You're using my car and you don't put any gas
right,
in it,
right.
You know." So anyway, he said, "Well, what would you do?" And I said, "You know, who plays on, you know," and he was telling me the different high schools.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, we gotta turn this into something bigger." And he says, "Well, what do you have in mind?" I says, "First of all, I just played the Beatles at the Civic Arena. I would want to put together a game that's big enough to go into the Civic Arena." He said, "Oh, you can't do anything like that." He says, "You got to go into a gymnasium, you know, high school." I said, no, we got to think, what's the biggest thing that we can do?
Wow.
And I was aware of that football game, you know, was it the Big 33 where Texas played?
Yeah, the All-Stars from all around the county would play the Texas All-Stars.
Right.
Same thing as your format. Go ahead.
And that's what I said. Let's just do that in basketball. I said, we have Pennsylvania. We'll play. He had all these ideas like, one county plays another county or something like that.
Right.
I said, no. I said, can we get enough good players out of Pennsylvania to play the United States? He's, "Oh, my God." He says, "That would be phenomenal." I said, "But do we have good players?" Mm-hmm. "Yeah, Philadelphia."
Right. Philly's got all the
ball players. All those people there, you know.
Yep.
And I said, "Well, that's what we got to do. We got to." So I says, "Who's the biggest name in basketball, in high school basketball?" He said, "Lou Alcindor." And I said, "Where is he?" He's at Power Memorial Academy in New York. The next day I got my car, I drove to New York, went to Power Memorial Academy, and met with his coach. And, you know, when I walked into the gym, it was a Catholic school there, and there weren't a whole lot of players, but I saw this really tall kid among all of them. I figured that was him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and to see his coach in the office, and I told the coach why I was there. And I had called him previously, and the coach said to me, "Well, if I send you my boy there," he said, "what's in it for me?"
Mm.
I said, I'm not following you. What do you mean? I said, "You could be the coach of the U.S. team." No. He says, "I want out of here. If my boy is going somewhere big, I want to go there as the coach of that team."
Wow.
"If you can arrange that."
Wow.
Yeah, I said, "You know, I'll see what I can do, but I don't think I can do that."
Yeah, that's a big order, right?
Yeah, so I had to go next down the line. I went to DeMath Catholic in Maryland, and I think we got two, Bernie Matthews, I think, from there.
Well,
anyway, put the tickets on sale, and, well, to do that, I went to the Post-Gazette, you know, the newspaper in town.
Yep.
to see if they would sponsor this. And there's this guy, Al Abrams, who's a sports editor. And he said to me, how much do you think this game is going to cost to produce? And I didn't have any idea.
Right.
I just plucked a figure out of here, and I said, $10,000. He said, okay, now tell me something. If I put our name, the newspaper's name, to this in our Dapper Dan Club, and no one showed up and it lost $10,000, who would pay for the loss? And I said, I would. And he says, okay, let's shake on that. And that was it.
Hmm.
Fortunately for me, he never asked me for proof of the $10,000 because I didn't have it, you know.
Right. Well,
Sonny didn't have anything.
Right.
Sonny was a school teacher, you know.
I didn't realize that Sonny got his start here in Farrell, right here in town here. That's an amazing story. I know you and I have talked. Hopefully I can get a chance to interview Sonny about that whole scene. Hey, listen, man, we are just about out of time here. Anything else that you want to say before we get out of here?
It was a pleasure talking. I love Youngstown. I went there, I went back, and my God, what they did to that camp.
Yeah, it's nice there now. It is. You're right. Yeah, we didn't even say your first concert was at YSU while you were still a student there. And we don't have time to talk about it. But like I said, I could spend another 5 hours with you, Pat. But listen, I so much appreciate you spending time with me and thoroughly enjoy this. And I'm sure my audience loved hearing your stories as well today.
Thanks, Eric.
Hey, man.
I loved it.
Well, I'm glad you did. And have a great night. Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Hey, wow, that's amazing. Hopefully I can get Sonny Vaccaro to come talk about his days at the Dapper Dan College. He's the guy that signed Michael Jordan when they were selling less tennis shoes than Adidas to the contract, and it was a big number. They did a 30 for 30 on it. Anyways, they went from selling a couple million tennis shoes to billions of dollars worth of tennis shoes. It was incredible, so I'd love to hear this story. You're listening to 790 WPIC. I'm Eric Bombeck. This is the Rock and Roll Garage.
From the Legacy Financial Strategy Studios, online at leavealegacy.com. News Talk 790 WPIC, Sharon Hermitage, Accumulus Station.